Well, I was thinking about these texts as I do every week as I get ready to come before you or whoever it is that I'm preaching towards. And I keep trying to it's really hard for me to get over the idea that I need to come and tell you something you haven't heard before, which is impossible. I look out there and I see people who have probably been reading the Bible for longer than I've been alive. And so the possibility of me coming up with something brand new is impossible unless I make something up. So I don't want to do that. And I think I may have shared with you once my analogy for preaching. And it's not so much that I'm telling you something new. What I think of instead, and I think this way because I have children who are artists, I think that what my job is, if I have to describe it in one way, is as an art critic. Now, I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to look at art with somebody who really knows art. Because what they do is when you're looking at a picture of a person, you're looking at a portrait, they don't say, "This is a person." You already know that. That's easy. I mean, that doesn't mean... What they say are things like, "Have you looked at it from this angle? Do you notice how they use shadow here and not here?" And so somebody who knows this stuff points out things about what you already know. And that's what I try to do when I'm here. I was given the great gift of being able to spend 6 years in fairly serious theological and biblical study, both as an undergrad and as a graduate, which I don't think very many of you had the same opportunity, so there are some things I know. And so when I was thinking about these texts, the phrase that came to mind as far as a sermon title goes is, "Do we really know?" And it comes from the disciples, and it comes from part of what Paul is alluding to in Philippians. But when the disciples see, particularly Judas Iscariot, who has his own problems, of course, but when the disciples see what happens at Bethany, that Mary comes in, takes this pint of perfume, as it says in here, but you think a large amount of perfume, very expensive, and pours it on Jesus' feet, what are these people thinking? Well, the thing is, what they're thinking doesn't matter, because the action is performed by Mary. And so the question comes, do we really know what somebody else is thinking when they do what they do? Well, and when we think about it in sort of the clear light of day, we say, of course we don't. We can't read minds. Even the people we've been, you know, attached to forever. I mean, Hadley and I have been together, married or together for almost 40 years now, which I realize for most of you is nothing, but for me it's a lot. And so we can do the things that drove our kids crazy by being in separate rooms and saying things like, "Will you bring me that thing?" And the other one will say, "This one?" And you say, "No, the other one." Well, you do that, and I'm sure all of you who've been connected with somebody for a long time, sometimes siblings can do it, but often married people can do that. You sort of think on the same wavelength. But I don't really know what Hadley's thinking. And so if I live in this world of thinking I know, I'm going to make mistakes that cause problems in my relationship with the person I love the most. So it took a while to learn to ask, "I think this is what's bothering you, is it?" is much better than going and fixing what I think is bothering them and just making things worse. I don't think this is limited to men, but we are especially good at it. We have the same problem here, and we see it. We look at the disciples, and I suspect Judas is really speaking for all of them. When Judas says, "What's going on? That was really expensive. It's been wasted on pouring on you when it could have been sold and the money given to the poor to put the best face on it." The fact that he was helping himself is sort of irrelevant. We often think that. But what did Mary think? What was Mary doing? According to Jesus, Mary was saving this perfume for the day of his burial, anointing his body before he's dead for the grave. And when you think of it that way, suddenly you change how you think. That's the wonderful thing about finding out what people actually mean by taking the time to ask them the questions to figure out what it is they're actually getting on about. Is it often changes your perspective. And so we have a different perspective on Mary here, not somebody wasting things, but doing a profound act of sacrifice in anointing Jesus' body before burial. That's what Jesus says was going on, and who are we to argue? The other one we want to look at is Paul. And so in Philippians, we have this really extraordinary list of things that Paul goes through. Paul is an odd character in some ways, because there's such a dramatic change in who he was, and yet at the same time we still see parts of Paul coming out. You read Galatians, and parts of the old Paul come out when he says some very, very severe things about the church in Galatia and what he wishes they would do. But if you only knew Paul from what he says here, what would you think? I mean, you have Paul talking about who he is. If anybody else think they have reason to put confidence in the flesh, to be confident in what they have accomplished, Paul says, I have more, which is arrogant. And then he goes through the list. He's of the nation of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, in regard to the law, a Pharisee, the religious superstars of the day. I mean, we just look at them through the lens of what we know looking back. At the time, Pharisees were looked up to as profoundly respectable religious people. And Paul was one of those. As for zeal, a persecutor of the church, and this one I find fascinating, as for legalistic righteousness, faultless. Now, there's a possibility this is just hyperbole, but let's not forget that Paul was the student of Gamaliel, who was the greatest Hebrew scholar of his day and is still being quoted in Hebrew studies today. Gamaliel was a genius. He taught Paul. That if Paul says, as for legalistic righteousness, what he's talking about is obeying not just the Ten Commandments, but the other 612 that are spread through the Old Testament. Things in Leviticus, things said again in Deuteronomy slightly differently. He's saying, I kept all of those. And we have no reason to believe that he didn't. This is the kind of person who has if he doesn't have rigid self-control, I don't know who does. You know, this is the kind of person who just, when he says this is what he's going to do, this is what he's going to do. He would have been a great golfer. You know, if the pro said, okay, I want you to look down, don't move your head, his head would not move. You know, he was just that kind of a person. What he decided, he did. So what do we really know at this point about Paul? We know nothing. Because Paul's next remark is, but whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. Anyone who knew Paul, the old Paul, the pre-Damascus Road Paul, would put him in a particular category. And it would be a category of a legalistic person who follows the law without giving any thought to the people involved, who just does what the book says. But what we see as we go on in that passage, and as we are familiar with Paul from other writings of his and from the writings about Paul in the book of Acts, we see someone who does care about people, who is compassionate, who does understand that there are times when you have to allow for the weakness of human beings, even if he never had any. Although, of course, he did. He even talks about it. But we go from this person who says, on the basis of the checklist, I'm perfect, to saying, no, none of that matters. And that brings me back to this whole idea of, do we really know? When someone does something nice for us, what do we think? A lot of it depends on how you were raised, how you were brought up. What's your experience with receiving gifts? There are some people that you do something nice for them, the first thing they think of is, what do you want? And if you weren't raised that way, you find that hard to believe. You're just thinking, I was at Tim's. I know you like a London Fog. I brought you a London Fog. There's nothing to it. And they say, no. What's behind the London Fog? And the answer is, there's nothing behind the London Fog. But for them, what do they really know? Well, they can't know what's going on in your head. None of us can. And I think on the whole, that's probably a pretty good idea. But what people do is they bring their own perspective, their own understanding to all of their interactions. We all do. We all have our own biases and our own ways of dealing with things, and they're not always great. So what do we do? Well, first of all, we answer the question, do we really know, with the word no. We don't. It's okay for us to try and find out. If I bring somebody something from Tim's or wherever, and they go, what's this for? And I say, yeah, I was there. I'd heard you talking about those. My partner Hadley likes London Fogs. I figured, so I brought you one. I hope you enjoy it. Have a great day. By them asking, what's this for, as opposed to what do you want, there's a possibility of us getting to the bottom of what's actually there. And all of us make assumptions about each other, and we have to. I mean, we can't just go through life, you're beginning every conversation with, do you speak English? Do you understand me? You know, there's a bunch of assumptions we make that are perfectly fine. But when we come into these other parts of life, when people are doing things for us, or are asking us to do things for them, or asking us to do things for the church, we need to remember that not only do we not really know what's going on in their head, they don't know what's going on in ours. The only way you can find out that asking someone to do something that makes them profoundly uncomfortable is to ask them if they are okay to do it, if this is something they would like to do. You don't know that when they were younger, they were taking up the offering, they dropped the offering plate, and the pastor from the pulpit yelled at them, and they've never been able to carry an offering plate since. Now, maybe counseling would help that, but that's not the time to insist that they carry an offering plate. We need to approach each other with an understanding of our own lack of understanding of what's going on in people. When you're talking to people and you ask, so what did you give up for Lent? And they say nothing. It's okay to ask a little bit, perhaps to find out why. It's not okay to say, well, you're giving up nothing for Lent. There's obviously something wrong with you. 2008 Lent. I didn't give up anything for Lent. Neither did my stepmother, because my dad had died in November before that. And she and I were talking about, she was my spiritual director before she became my step. It's really complicated. When your dad marries one of your former professors, it makes for some odd things. We'll just leave it at that. But we talked about this, and we said, we've given up a lot already. So instead of giving up something for Lent, what we did is we set aside, in our own ways, a little bit of extra time to ponder what it means to give up things knowing we will get them back at the end of all things. If somebody would have just written me off because I didn't do what they did at Lent, and I use Lent as an example because we're in the just about done it, but still in the middle of it. We need to remember that we don't really know a lot about how other people think and why other people do things. And so when we're driving along and we see a sign of any kind on somebody's yard and we put them in a category, we need to hold on to that category very lightly, because we don't know what's going on. We don't know why they have that there. We don't know if it's a political thing that we don't agree with or that we do agree with. We can't just assume they think exactly like us, because they probably don't. They're different people. If it's about anything, these assumptions, these expectations that we place on other people, are more dangerous to us than they are to them. So it's worth it for us to pay attention to those. If any of you know anybody in recovery or in the recovery movement, do you know what they call expectations? Preemptive resentments. The expectations we put on other people, particularly when we don't tell them about them, often make us resent them because they're not doing what we expect them to do, but we never asked them or told them or even suggested that because we don't really know. We think they do, but they don't. It's okay for us to spend a little bit of time trying to figure out what our neighbors are thinking and what they're doing and why they're doing things. And I'm not talking about interrogating people. It's just a matter of taking the time to hold on to our assumptions lightly and to be willing to risk asking people. I don't really, what do you mean by that? I don't understand. That was a weird thing when I was growing up. It seems like it was a good thing for you. What's going on? The possibility of fruitful conversations and a deepening relationship happen when we stop assuming we know. It doesn't always work. Nothing always works. I mean, there's always something that can go wrong, and I don't want to suggest that having an open mind and asking people what's going on is going to fix everything, because of course it won't. But it won't hurt, and most of the time, it helps. We often work ourselves into these sort of semi-frenzies. Where I work, there's a whole bunch of other people who work. They all work in cubicles. They've all known each other for a long time. I don't know any of them, except, well, I know Hadley. My partner works there and took over their job, in fact, which is kind of funny. But I ask people, I'm sorry, I've lost your name. And they tell me what their name is. And I started doing that a long time ago because I told someone, a wise person, that it was embarrassing forgetting somebody's name and I hate asking. And he said, when somebody asks you what your name is because they've forgotten it, are you angry with them? He said, no, of course not. He said, then stop looking down on your fellow human beings and feeling superior. This is somebody who knew me well and knew that I needed a whack between the eyes to pay attention and realized that when you ask somebody, I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name, hardly anybody is offended by that. I've never met anybody who's offended by that. But if I assume that, it interferes with all kinds of things. And as I was looking at these texts and as I was thinking of this divisive world that we're in, where everybody seems to be taking sides on everything, I thought, maybe it wouldn't hurt for us to be reminded that we don't always know what other people are thinking or why, and that it's okay to ask. It's okay to explore what's going on, particularly with people who are close to you and you don't understand what they're doing or thinking. Because you can't know. You don't have to know. But if you ask, then you probably will. Amen.